So we are looking at chapter 36, which is 43 verses. And if you read ahead, it's one of those passages we call genealogical. Let's begin, though, with the first couple of verses to lay the context here before us. In chapter 36, like verses 1 to 3 or so, this is the genealogy, or in the Hebrew, the Toledot. You've heard me mention that. This is what became of Esau. You could even read it. Who is Edom? Now, I'll just mention that. You'll see that phrase, that Esau is Edom, about a half a dozen times in this chapter. So we're emphasizing that Esau is Edom, just like Jacob is Israel. They're both nations, in a sense. So he is Edom. He took his wives from the daughters of Canaan, Ada, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, Aholibamah, the daughter of Avna, the daughter of Anna, the daughter of Zibeon the Hivite, and Basemat, Ishmael's daughter, sister of Nebaioth. Now, Ada bore Eliphaz to Esau, and Basemat bore Reuel. Okay, we're going to stop there, and let me just give you a little geography. It says he's Edom. He took them from Canaan. Let me see if I can kind of give us a little geography here. This is looking from the south to north. There's the Jordan River Sec area, the Rift Valley, lowest part of the world right there at the Dead Sea. And you can see the Jordan Valley there. This is the bottom of the Dead Sea, looking north. Canaan to the left, you see the Judean Hills. You see where, over here, where Isaac is, and where Jacob is going to end up over in Haran Hebron. Now here's the Judean Hills, where David spent a lot of time. Sea of Galilee is up there. So you get a sense of the region. Syria to the northeast, and then Moab, Edom, and a place called Petra, and here's Mount Seir. Sometimes Edom is called Seir. This is region over here, so you can gather. It's pretty arid, pretty dry, pretty hot, pretty rugged territory. This is where Edom, where Esau goes. Just to give you a feel for it, when it's famous, one of the most famous parts of this region is a place called Petra. Using the miracle of drones, we'll take a tour. And so that little valley area that you take in, like I said, it's about a mile long walk. That made it very hard to conquer because it would take very little to defend that kind of a region. And then I think what led to the conquest was keep cut off the water, typical strategy. But you could see that goes back to 400 years before Christ, has a tremendous history. It was lost to history until the middle, late 1800s, someone discovered it, heard rumors about it, and knew that the Arabs were talking about it, so talked around, checked around, and finally convinced someone to take him in, and just, it was discovered again. So it's a fascinating area. But that kind of gives you a picture of what the area of Edom is like, the area that Esau called home. Again, looking at a map, here's kind of the Edomite territory. Again, you see the Sea of Galilee up here, Mediterranean Sea. Edomites from 2000 to 1400 BC is what they're saying here. The Moabites, the Ammonites in this region. And this is, here is up here, would be the Jabbok River we saw. Here's some other key rivers. Here's Jerusalem, Hebron. You get the feel for this region.
So are there two separate Edomite areas?
No,
that's a title up there.
Yeah. This is the Edomite region here. And then in New Testament times, you'll hear about Herodian family being Edomian. That would be descendants, ultimately, of the Edomite region. This is just to put it in the Bible you orient towards the east. So kind of hard on the neck, but it also makes it bigger. But that just gives you a feel for, again, you can kind of see rocky, dry, hot. But that's where he went, we're told from the scriptures. Now, here's the assignment I want to give you. Oh, starting around verse, really, you can go all the way back to verse 1 or 2, to say verse 10. Let's say verse 11. Well, let me think. All the way down through, I think, verse 14. I would like you, if you have a piece of paper or some other fashion, make a chart. Just maybe work together with your team there. If you need paper, we have some available. Make a chart. Just try and put it, just read it and say, you know, like, okay, here's Esau. You probably need a way to mark each of his three wives. And then who are their kids? Just real briefly to help you observe the text if you want. You can work as a team if you like. Here's what I got for Esau, the first section here, and that would be through verse 14. Esau, who is Edom, we see him having his three wives, Adah or Ada, Aholibama, and Basemath. I went ahead and just noticed a couple things. There's a couple of times where we're told something about someone, and that's worth noting. I didn't always do it. But notice...
Cindy did.
There we go. So the pink ones, obviously, those are the wives. Now, before we go any further, Cindy had a question about that. What was your question, Cindy, or comment?
What about Judah from Genesis 26:34? And Esau was 40 years old when he took to wife Judah, the daughter of Beeri, the Hittite. And
Bashemath,
the daughter of
Elon
the Hittite.
Okay, so what do we do with the fact those names are different than these names?
Well, Bashemath kind of lines up.
So pardon me?
Bashemath kind of lines up. So
yes, except Bashemath, we're told, was the, in this text, is an Ishmaelite.
They're different spellings for the same person.
It's possible. That one... Probably the answer that makes sense to me is sometimes people have different, you know, multiple names, and so there are maybe just different names being used in those two passages. Some have suggested, and it wouldn't be out of line, that Esau had lots of wives. The problem is then we don't know really any of the children of those earlier chapters. So I'm inclined to say these are just alternative names from some of the, and that was only two wives, that the Hittite wives, or mentioned that it took an Ishmaelite, I can't remember if we're told her name.
So Judith is probably Adah or something like that?
Yes. So that would probably be the way I would take it. So then you notice if we're going down, Adah is the first wife mentioned at Eliphaz, that's his firstborn, we're told. But there was also Teman, Omar, Zepho, Gatam, Kenaz, and Amalek, born by Timnah. And then Aholibama, a Hittite, also Jeush, Alam, and Korah, and Basemath, an Ishmaelite. Remember when he found out back in that earlier chapter, when he finally got through his thick skull that his family didn't approve of his Canaanite wives, he went to family and married an Ishmaelite, a daughter of Ishmael. And that gave him the son Reuel and Nahath, Zerah, Shema, and Mizah. I'll just notice two names, and this I put up from here, Eliphaz and Teman. If you read the book of Job recently, you know, sometimes, you know, it's still, wait a minute, I saw that name. Those are two names that we see in the book of Job. Eliphaz, of course, is one of his, we call him friends. Teman is Arab. And so one of the things you're going to see is there, these different, whether these guys will eventually kind of be identified partially with the areas that they seem to have led. And Uz, we'll see in a later list, you know, that's where Job was from. But that's, again, a personal name.
Where's Uz?
We'll see him in the later list. You didn't get to him yet because those are the sons of Seir, the Horite. So, notice some colors. Why do I have the three on top in pink?
The white.
Girls.
Yes, they're females. And there is such a thing as a female. Then I have the Esau is in red, and, you know, kind of a, why did I put him in red?
Firstborn.
Because firstborn, maybe? Remember, that's what his name, he was hairy, and he was red-colored. So I put him in red. Edom means, Adom is the Hebrew word for red. So like a red skeleton, red. Or you could call him hairy or red, and either way it'd be. So I put him in red, and some two of his sons in red. I put them all in red, actually. And then I read on, and if you look in...
You found some that were purple?
Pardon me?
You read on and found some that were purple.
Yeah, that's right. I found some purples here. Well, starting around verse 15, you know, you heard of, is it purple states? Is that what they call them? Uh-huh. Blue and red? So starting at verse 15, these were the chiefs of the son of Esau, of the sons of Esau. Sons of Eliphaz, the firstborn son of Esau, were Chief Teman, Chief Omar, Chief Zeppo. So if you read down through to verse 19, not everyone was a chief. And the word chief, okay, Mark, you read the King James, right? No?
Yes, yes.
The old King James.
Yes, yes.
What do they call them? Not chiefs, but what?
Oh, dukes.
Dukes.
The dukes.
So you could call these the Dukes of Hazzard. Duke, chief. Any of the translations come up? You see any of the words from the group? If the word chief kind of looks like it's related to the word thousand. So this might be someone who had a thousand or thousands under his command. So he's not a king, but he had leadership over a large group. If you had leadership over a thousand men, that's a lot of families, especially back in that time frame, and especially in that region. You can imagine it wasn't highly, highly populated. But by the way, as you start looking at this and see that all his sons had sons who were chiefs, maybe having a thousand people under them, you can start to make sense about how Esau could easily gather 400 people. Remember, too, he's the older brother of Jacob by a few moments, but his family started much quicker, right, than Jacob's. He was already married to two of his wives before Jacob even left on the journey to work 7 years for his wives. So Esau got a real jump on things. But there, so the purple ones, royalty, okay? So that's why the chiefs are in purple in my scheme. If you look at your handout, they're not in purple. I expected David would be here tonight, and so I knew I couldn't do that.
Thank you.
Okay, so far, does that make sense of what I'm doing? Oholibamah.
Was purple?
He wasn't one of the chiefs. He's not in the list of chief, listed as a chief.
But is he the first of that?
He's the first of he's the only of child of Basemath. Mm-hmm. And Eliphaz is the only, mm-hmm, where Oholibamah, he had three. She had three. I have her in blue, by the way. Why do I have her in blue? And Timnah is in blue also. Amalek was not born to, his mother was Timnah. Let's look at this next list and it'll make some sense.
Was that a concubine?
Yes.
Yes, that was a concubine, if I recall. One of them is a concubine. I think that was the one.
Yes, it is.
Timna was the concubine. Now, here's what's interesting. Here is an unrelated family, but another major people group that's also in the region of Edom. Okay? So these are not descendants of Esau, but there's some intermarrying. So, Oholibamah is a daughter of Anah, who is the son of Seir. Okay, so there's this another family. They're called Horites, or Hurrians, ancient historians will call them. So this is another, we're just being told, a whole other population that's also in Edom. Okay? So this is like describing the Hatfields and the McCoys. Okay? That's all that is. But there is some intermarrying. And we see some of the more of the framework. So there's Oholibamah in blue to remind us she's a descendant of Seir. Okay? She is one of the wives of Esau. So there's an intermarrying that probably was kind of like a, you know, cooperation of these nation peoples.
Political,
yeah. And so then the other one I want to mention is, here's Timnah. One of his daughter, she's in pink, but I have her with purple writing. She is the concubine from whence we get Amalek. Now, Amalek's an important name.
That's the Amalekites?
That's the Amalekites. They are going to be a real problem to Israel when they're coming up from, and as a matter of fact, when they were reading along, and when Moses was writing this and he was reading it to the people, they all hissed and booed when they named Amalek. This is the one that wouldn't let them pasture their land. They wouldn't even let them buy water. They said, we'll buy water. We won't touch a thing. We'll pay for anything we take or use. Nope. So they had to add to the trip, go back down south, go further around through the desert, 2 million people. That's not how you make friends, but you do influence people. Later on, Saul is told, destroy the Amalekites. And what happened?
He does not
destroy the Amalekites. He loses his kingdom. We have another Amalekite surfacing later on in Scripture. Haman. So, all that to say, this is kind of an important connection, you know, so you see some of the connections. His Seir's sons are all chiefs. The rest are not named as such. Dishon, why is that one in yellow?
Mustard.
Inventor of mustard, yes. Right here. You always wondered where it came from. I'm sorry, I couldn't help myself. And that's in yellow also, though.
God.
Yeah, and I don't like mustard. Okay, so with me so far?
Never mind.
Well, obviously the delivery was not adequate, was not as it could have been. If George were teaching, it would have worked.
He just couldn't hear
it.
He would have been joking.
By the way, Anah discovered water. Yamin, which is not the normal word for water. It's not the normal word for mules. Some of you may have mules or horses or something in there. Most people think it's probably referring to hot springs. This word is only used here in the Scriptures, and there are hot springs in that region. So just a comment is made, just in passing, because it was a noteworthy thing for that region. And here's Uz. And so he was probably influential in the region, and the region was named after Uz, from whence Job came. Okay.
he the inventor of the Uzi?
Pardon me?
Is he the inventor of the Uzi?
Yes, absolutely. That was his son. Uz and then Uzi.
And the mustard comes out.
Yeah. Okay? So kind of make sense. So by the way, I'm going to guess Seir had more daughters than we see named. But we're told in the genealogy the two that are important. Okay, that's what you'll see sometimes. Like Jacob had more daughters than Dinah. But she plays an important part in the narrative, and so she's included. Normally we just name the men because those are the ones who are going to carry on the family line to be the inheritors of whatever happened. But when these are particularly significant, they're included. And I don't know any evidence enough to support that this was the whole ring was the made horseradish. So I just let that one.
Okay.
How are we doing so far? Okay. So, like Cindy, as I was reading this, I was like, I got to see a chart. And then I thought, you know, if I look at a chart, I still got to double check it. So I just sat down and just started doing this. And so there could be errors in what you're seeing. This is what I put together as I read through it and prepared the text and all that. Now, then we're told about the reigns of the kings of Edom. So we've gotten some of the genealogies down 31 and 39 to 39. These were the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the children of Israel. Bela, the son of Beor, reigned in Edom. The name of the city was Dinhabah. Bela died. Jacob, the son of Zerah of Bozrah, reigned in his place. When Jobab died, Husham of the land of the Temanites. See, there's Teman there that we still see in Job, reigned in his place. When Husham died, Hadad, the son of Bedad, who attacked Midian in the field of Moab, reigned in his place, and the name of his city was Abi. Okay, we could read on. Tell me, as you look at that and think about the kings of Israel, does anything strike you?
There are no dynasties, there are no son.
There's no, yes, you always see, don't you, in Israel, it's the son of so-and-so, the son, unless there was a murder or something like that, there was a coup, or what in the Hebrew is called an impeachment, but if something like that happens, then, but otherwise, there's a dynasty, no dynasty here.
So they just took over.
Yes, yeah, so these
one
kings.
One died, they just moved in, they
yeah.
were entitled.
Right, someone else came in who was stronger. It was not a family, it was not an inheritance, it was not a dynasty. Good. What else do you notice? There was no settled capital. With many of these new king comes on, he has a new capital. So there's not a settled dynasty. And so one of the things that we are so blessed in America, that we have such peaceful transitions of power. You know, it's amazing. Every 4 years, we have these elections, and maybe at least every 8 years, there's a switch of power. There's no military uprising. You know, you look at some parts of the world, every few years, there's a coup. Here come the armies come into the capital. We don't do that. Well, it lacks stability. Every king was replaced by someone else, the next strong guy. He moved the capital. You get the feel. It was a time of instability. So there were many kings from Edom with no stability. The Davidic kings are chosen by God, and they have a lasting capital, Jerusalem. I mean, it's actually going to be the capital of the Messiah when he comes. Proverbs 28:2 says, because of the transgression of a land, many are its princes. But by a man of understanding and knowledge, right will be prolonged. In other words, I think what that's saying is, if you have to go through, you know, that suggests to me many princes, an unstable government. And so that's a sign of a land that's not blessed and is not healthy. if the government is constantly flipping over. If I can bring two examples that's kind of troubling, the United Kingdom and Israel have a parliamentary system, which we Americans understand about as well as we understand, what's that baseball game they play? Cricket. What is this? But you notice, like in Britain, they're through a couple of changes of government very quickly. They're going into their third national vote in a year in Israel because they can't form a government. And so there's just an instability. Well, that's not good for a country. That's not a, where we're blessed with stability. We sometimes the guy we want is elected, sometimes not. We have our frustrations, but there's a general stability that may be, it seems to be changing. Joshua.
The last king, why does it mention his wife's name and his daughter's name?
Down here, when Baal-Hanan, the daughter of Achbor, died, Hadar reigned in his place, and the name of his city was Pau. His wife's name was Mehetabel, the daughter of Matred, the daughter of Mezahab. I don't know. That's a very good observation. That tells me they're significant. And that might have been certain, at least to the people in Moses' day, those ladies would have been known for some reason. And that's the kind of thing that says, let's go find out. I wonder if there's anything we can find out about them. Of course, we don't have any records from the Edomites that can help us. But that tells me that you're right. That's a very significant. I can't tell you the significance, but that's a good observation. So when you see the names of women, you should say, that's interesting that we're told that.
Do you think there's another Hadar and this distinguishes him? Make sure they get the right one.
I don't know. Could it have been that there's other Hadars around? That would distinguish them. And she was the daughter of Matred, the daughter of Mezahab. That suggests to me there's maybe a related to someone significant. That's interesting.
Do you think Joe Bob up there was in Texas?
I think so.
Joe Bob was definitely, or some southern region. He may have.
Yes.
The Edomites and the Moabites are right together.
Pardon?
And the Edomites and the Moabites are right together.
Yes.
And Moses married the Moabites.
Okay, so you're thinking maybe there was some familiarity with with the Moabites because of Moses' connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Good point.
Was surprised if that's the same Eliphaz as in Job and the same Teman. Though they aren't very good friends, they seem to have a lot more knowledge and thought about God than I would have thought Esau's descendants would have had.
Yes, okay, now we're going back to the descendants of Esau. Yes. Of course, Teman is just, that's just a location. So we don't know really about anything. But apparently, in this part of the world, the southern part of that Edomite region, was known for its wisdom, a place where wise people, were. So Eliphaz, who knows? Maybe he knew. Maybe through family or something, he came to know more about God.
Didn't David take his parents and family over to, was it Moab? Things were getting testy with Saul.
Over to Moab, which is in the general region. It's north of Edom. Why would he go to Moab, David? We're jumping ahead a few hundred years.
Because
his mother was Moabite. Oh. Or his grandmother. Remember?
Ruthie.
Yeah, Ruthie. Came from Moab. So, I think he pulled in some family connections there. Well, good. Some good observations on the kings here. In the land of Edom. But again, they reigned in Edom, but we're not told how they all relate. But just there was just a lot of them. But notice that expression. Genesis 36:31. Now these were the kings that reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the children of Israel. This whole list precedes any king in Israel. So Esau, Edom, was a much more nationally developed. And so again, here he comes with his 400 men. They had a lot more kings, which again, lots of kings isn't always good, but the long before Israel had kings. Now remember, why didn't Israel have kings as quickly?
They weren't supposed to.
They weren't supposed to. That's a good. Wasn't that something right? So who gave them leadership?
Samuel
and the judges, and then they insisted on a king. So, but now here's what someone will say: wait a minute, Moses is writing this. They don't have a king till Saul. How could Moses have written about this? But in Deuteronomy, he talked about that when you have a king. But also here in Genesis 35:11, God said to him, "I'm God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall proceed from you, and kings shall come from you." So God had predicted there would be kings. But the Edomites had a lot more kings before even the first king of Israel. So
how do you qualify a population number before you have somebody that's a king over them? I mean, could it be 10, 20, 30, 40, 50? We don't know that, do we?
Typically, suppose asking, when is it a kingdom? The typical at this time, I think we would say most kingdoms would be centered around a city. Again, with people back then, they didn't really live in the city. Some did. But the city was more a hub. I mean, that was a place of trade. That was a place of safety. When invaders came, you'd go and run into the city and close the gates. So all the people who worked out in the fields, lived out in the fields, didn't necessarily live in the city, but they would, being close to the city, often the city would have water, have trade, have resources, have safety. But so a lot of times, like you see, Melchizedek was the king of Salem, Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And so just that, so there would have been, you know, thousands would have been a pretty good sized kingdom.
They were like governors, or
yes, yeah. What we would consider, and so
mayors,
a lot of these kings and these chiefs, or governors, probably a bigger idea, but you know, more like an idea, but more like a mayor, and that is one city.
Right.
I wonder how they associated just because of geographic location, or they paid taxes, or somehow they identified as part of that kingdom.
Okay. Again, part of that is. Yeah, sometimes there's some kind of a tax, so you have the rights to come into the town in times of hazard. This region is in a trade zone. It's a trade route. And so that means you would have the merchants coming and going. You might charge toll. And so that reason, this is actually an area that probably had a pretty decent income from trade. The spice trade, for example, would have come through this region in some ways.
Toll tags,
exactly. So, here's the question for you. If you were going to preach on this passage on Sunday, what kind of thoughts come to your mind that you might develop to preach on? What benefits did you pull out of this? Okay, good, I congratulate you. Good observation. Joshua, for example, you start to pick up on, wait, what are women doing in here? Why are they in pain? You see some of the relationships. Good, to compare. Wait a minute, we weren't told about his wives. Why are their names different? So those are good study things.
No mention of God in the whole chapter.
No mention of God in the whole chapter. Did anyone see the name of God in there? No. Good. Yes.
I looked up what the names meant, and this is not like really accurate, but some of the first was like Eliphaz, my God is strength, my God is fine gold. Raul was friend of God, but by the time you get down to the bottom of the list, a burnt valley, this purchase, this lamentation, people that will take all away, and so they really get very negative.
The names do become, there's a good observation. Eliphaz and other names, that E-L, watch for that, is a probable pointing to God. But you don't see anything like that. Anything ending in Yah, especially anything in Ale, throughout those names. They're, sparrow or whatever. It's nature things. And so that tells you. It's interesting in history and archaeology. You can partially date things based on the common names that are being used in the literature. Haven't you noticed that? An older woman who has, I'm trying to think of...
Maud.
Maud, yeah. what's the... she might be Hephzibah or Beulah. Now, one thing is funny, some of these names come back, right?
Yep.
But has anyone heard of a Beulah recently?
No, that was my grandmother's.
But you see what I'm saying? We can look at certain names and say that came from, and some of them, you can see where there's a strong biblical influence. Anyway, all that to say, these names reflect a culture. And this culture.
So,
would
you say some of these names are more applicable to the East over in that region today?
You might see some of those more. It's interesting. For a while there in Israel, the name Anat was popular for a girl's name, which is shocking because that's a Canaanite goddess. But the name Anat was in the news a lot because they were discovering tablets with some of this literature. But that just shows you, one, the secularism of modern Israel. But also, why were they using that? Because they were discovering those texts, and that was all of a sudden an interesting name. So certainly, names tell us about culture, values, and this is a godless period. And there's no mention of God, except for maybe first generation around the time of Esau. Good.
Jacob could see he'd go from place to place, and for all his flaws, he'd be building altars or pillars, and there's no
mention. No hint of an altar. Yeah, good.
Therefore, in America, you see more New Testament names. Except for George. Wait.
Oh,
George.
I think that's the name of a theme.
Yeah.
A theme George. Is that, the rulers come up and nations rise and fall, but, it doesn't matter because just, the Lord's will prevail over everything.
Okay. Nations rise and fall, but God accomplishes his purpose. Yeah, look at all this. It's huge. It's all this history we don't know anything about, right? Except that we just read about it.
You mentioned that area was a place of wisdom, but it had to be human wisdom because those that came to Job were way off base.
Yeah. It was kind of it's a merit system. You earned this. You deserved this. Yeah. Egypt was and Babylon were famous for their wisdom council. But it wouldn't necessarily be biblical counsel, yeah. Mark.
When were Esau and Jacob together? Because I thought Jacob settled up here and Esau was down here, but now it says he went to a country away from his brother because they couldn't live together with all their possessions and their animals.
So there's that statement. He left because... And what, does that sound like another narrative with
Lot?
Yeah, and he also headed east. Yes, he left because I think my take on that is, I'm not sure if I can be dogmatic, but my sense is that what that's referred to is the fact that he recognized all his father's flocks were Jacob's. Jacob was the heir. And so when he was leaving, he viewed all that as already Jacob's. So he had to, but he was doing very well, thank you. And so he moved east, away from the family, and as the non-heir son.
Listen to that. It's interesting that God promised Israel, promised land to Jacob and Abraham and Isaac, and so it's Esau that moves away from that.
Yeah, he knew this wasn't his land, and it wasn't his place. Mark?
Back to the, you know, you were talking about government systems and that kind of stuff. And, I mean, one of the things that came out of this drama in England is they don't have a written constitution. And you think about, and I mean, okay, this is pre-law in Genesis, but it's like when you leave the guidance or the standards or the, you know, in our case we have the scriptures that as you depart from that or you don't have a record of it, then I think, you know, things go unstable like they did here.
The law changes every time we have a new king. Mm-hmm. It could have been back then, yeah. Well, I'll tell you, one of the things where I see going with this is that Esau and the whole and Seir, we're talking two major powerful lineages, families, extended families that are prospering. There is apparently wealth. I mean, you know, like again, you talk about him having too many flocks. You looked at those pictures of Petra, and you're thinking. But did you notice there were goats running around in the rocks and all that? Mm-hmm. I'll just, in passing, mention, many believe that this is where Israel will flee there during the tribulation. And so some have so thoroughly believed that they've invested substantial amounts of money to squirrel away Bibles in lots of those little caves all through the area. But here's my point. There's this prosperity. There is this abundance. The numbers, like there's so many of the sons have thousands under them. But it's all without God. And here is the chosen family. One son having one child, two child. In their case, you know, Jacob is with the help of four wives, 12 sons. But you see, they're not nearly as abundant and powerful as godless Esau. And so there's, to me, there's a picture that, and yet God's blessing is on the chosen people. And it's often we might look and say, well, yeah, but they have so much wealth, they have so much power, they have so much influence, and we have God. You know, and so, yeah, there was some good observation that he's not mentioned. He's hinted at in the earliest generation of names. That's telling. That's telling. And so, just a reminder, our ambition shouldn't be on the side of being in the greatest power center. Our ambition should be with the greatest power center, and that's God. But not to be discouraged, distraught, or attracted by the prosperity, the prominence, and the power of the pagans. How's that for on-the-spot alliteration?
Broad is the way and narrow is the gate.
What's that?
Is it broad is the way and narrow is the gate?
Yeah, broad is the way, narrow the path. And so that's definitely to be reminded at a time like that. Well, good. I hope you get some more out of that passage. You notice we are doing the whole chapter. We're not going to try and break that down into four or five sermons.
Thank you.
You're welcome.